Welcome to Film Strips, the podcast that is taking a look at the second movie on the show that happens to have a score by one Ennio Morricone. I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I'm Andrew Kanigiser.
Did I pronounce that correctly?
I'm pretty sure it's Ennio. But
Ennio Mar.
Yeah, I like it better as Eno because Brian Eno is one of my favorite musicians, and I like to think he's the missing link between the two. He does really, really wonderful soundtracks consisting of, like, amplifier hums and Robert Fripp playing guitar. Little inside baseball to put off the three listeners that we did have at the beginning. How are you tonight, Dave?
I'm doing quite fine. How about yourself?
Oh, I'm doing well enough. Had a lovely day with my daughter, and just put her to bed, and now time to pull the lid off a stirring meditation on modern racism. So, where were we last week?
So for any new listeners that happen to be coming to the show, welcome. We are the podcast in which we discuss a movie each episode, but somehow the film each week has to connect back to the film that preceded it based upon someone who is either part of the cast or crew or whatever. And last week, we were taking a look at the one, the only, Eating Raoul. Literally the only film quite like it in existence.
Yes, it's decidedly singular.
Yeah. And Andrew, that was my pick, and part, you know, it was a great film from Paul Bartel. So where did you choose to take us this week?
Well, it turns out that our good friend Paul Bartel has a bit part in the 1982, certainly not a hit, the lost masterpiece, I guess, to most, Samuel Fuller's 1982 social drama White Dog. And I think that's an interesting jump to make. Also because, a lot of the threads we were talking about last week and the idea of sort of alternative cinema and even non-mainstream and even non-independent filmmaking, Paul Bartel is a big figure there, but so is Samuel Fuller as well. So I think it would be an interesting opportunity to continue the conversation somewhat.
No, absolutely. And for anybody, again, tuning in for the first time, keep in mind, we spoil the heck out of the films we talk about on this show, so if you want to go in and watch something completely clean, this is basically your point to jump out for now, and then come back to us after you watched it to hear what we have to say.
Yes.
If you don't mind listening to us, by all means, continue to listen on.
Yes. Abandon all complaints, ye who enter here. Yeah. And I guess this episode probably has another qualifier that we should add. This is a film that deals pretty heavily with themes of race, with themes of hatred, themes of redemption. Just to qualify everything, Dave, you and I, we are both Caucasian cis males that live in Canada. Our perspective on things is, I guess you could say, it's founded in the academy. It's certainly our goal to be able to discuss the nuances and complexities of this film, and indeed the topics raised by this film, in a respectful way. If we do misspeak or anything like that, or if we overlook something, please, we mean no offense. And if you do take umbrage, feel free to shout us out on Twitter and show us all the different things that we can do to learn more. We want to be allies here. So, and I know that everybody who is about to do the wrong thing says, please, have a little faith. But here we go. I mean, we're the only two hosts that we have, so we got to make this one work.
Yeah, so I guess, you know, since we're sort of highlighting right up front that this film deals with some rather controversial subject matter and, to say the least, about it, maybe a very quick plot description for this film is worth explaining up front, and then we'll dive back into the background of what this, how this film came about.
I agree with you there, Dave, because I think at heart, White Dog is a very simple film, if you're looking purely at its narrative, but if you're looking at what it's saying at the register of themes and social commentary, it's much, much more complicated than that. Because really, this film, It can be given like the All-Star Superman treatment. It's young woman injures dog, takes dog home, realizes that the dog has been trained not just to be an attack dog, but specifically a white dog, which historically are dogs, generally German Shepherds, Dobermans, that are raised specifically to target and attack black individuals. She discovers this, and she befriends a pair of animal trainers, and the one trainer, Keys, a black man, takes it upon himself to see whether or not he can break down the dog and recondition it to learn to live without its hatred. Is that about the ballpark?
That is basically, the simple, straight-ahead version of it, which... Yeah, as you've acknowledged, Andrew, is very straightforward. But even I think within the frame of that, I think anybody who's just hearing about this film for the first time can probably understand why this is a pretty loaded movie to be getting into in terms of its subject matter and what it's talking about. Because, man oh man, that's diving headfirst into territory that could go... exceptionally wrong.
And I mean, we've talked at length before how Hollywood seems to have a serious problem dealing with depictions of wealth and sort of like its own disavowal of hyper-capitalism, how Hollywood has severe difficulty representing itself in a non-mythologized form. And I mean, we've all seen films sort of coming out of the 1970s and afterwards where their films, even something like Paul Haggis's Crash, a film where, you know, it's a film about race and the issues left behind in American history and unresolved conflicts, but it all gets boiled down and oversimplified where, well, everybody learns an important lesson and racism is over forever. I think when Paramount agreed to make this film in 1982, that was certainly a danger. But I think the smartest thing they did was that they chose Samuel Fuller to direct this movie. And Samuel Fuller is a person that, criminally underseen, but those who know his work would know that there's no such thing as a straightforward treatment in any of his films.
Yeah, and the thing about Fuller, for those who aren't familiar with him, basically Fuller started off as a journalist and, lived a, very sort of rough and tumble life long before he ever got into film. He was also a World War II veteran who eventually worked his way into both writing pulp novels and eventually screenplays, and which he eventually parlayed into being able to direct his own work. That starts in the 1940s when he begins directing with a film called I Shot Jesse James, which at 82 minutes is much shorter than The Assassination of Jesse James by the Robert Lee Coward Ford.
Oh, that's so much.
Yeah.
That's the Earth 2 version.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's 82 minutes. I mean, after some of the movies we've watched for this show, that sounds like a downright vacation.
Yeah, and the thing about Fuller is, he had mixed success. He had some, relatively high-budget Hollywood films he worked on, and he usually worked more in modest means or worked very much towards the fringes, because without giving an entire biography of his life, which is very tough to do in the format of this show that we have, Fuller... was somebody who in many ways could be listed as sensationalistic in terms of the types of stories they like to do. He was very much cut and dry in the sense of there's kind of an OBS approach to what he does. When he wants to talk about something, he's going to probably tell you right to your face what you're talking about. But he's not sentimental, number one, I think is the easiest way. And he's also somebody who I think quite honestly, for whatever his faults, either as a filmmaker or storyteller that you can consider, he had a very nuanced view of not only what you can do in storytelling, but also of America as a whole. His entire filmography is, to greater and lesser extremes, about basically how messed up America is in one form or another.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you look at, I think that description holds for a lot of his films, even working through like the 1950s and 60s, like a film like Shock Corridor is, it sounds sensationalistic and exploitative. A journalist goes undercover at a mental hospital to investigate the conditions there. And, I mean, it sounds like built for drive-in entertainment. But Fuller's also the kind of filmmaker where he uses that into to like springboard himself into that deep discussion of, well, what do we mean in the discourse of modern medicine? Like, what is insanity? Is it something that we induce in other people because we run our hospitals so terribly? Like, is there something about American culture that just drives people crazy anyway? Like, he's working within that Roger Corman vein of subject matter, but his treatment of those subjects, it is very journalistic, and it is very, like, his style is no BS, but also his arguments looking at America itself are also no BS. Like, he doesn't make comfortable films.
No, absolutely not. And I think one of the things that's very telling about Fuller is, given the context of the eras in which he worked, he was typically drawn to marginalized individuals and certainly try to comprehend the power structures that end up marginalizing them. Now, that's not to say, again, that he was perfect at this. He was still a white filmmaker dealing with subjects of racism, it's hard not to look at something like The Steel Helmet, a film that explicitly features an interracial military unit during the Korean War and the tensions that exist between them, and, you know, very bluntly calling out the hypocrisy of America. I mean, there's a wonderful scene where basically an enemy soldier starts trying to convince a black medical doctor that's part of the unit. It's like, why are you supporting this? You know the history of the country you're part of. You know how what happened to your ancestors and what they are continuing to do to you now. Why are you still fighting with these people? And, you know, he doesn't give the answer that comes out of that is not a pat one by any stretch of the imagination. It's like, yeah, America's messed up, but it's messed up in our backyard and we got to take care of it. Period. It's very fascinating, and I'm doing a terrible job of communicating the nuance of what Fuller pulls off in that film. But it's something that he's been, you know, that's recurs throughout his entire career as a filmmaker. And it's kind of interesting when you come to this film, because certainly Fuller was not on his commercial game by this point, by a long shot. And needless to say, I think given the source material, which I have not read, but I've read about, he had some work to do to make this thing less problematic, yeah. To say.
Yeah, so, I mean, the context of this film is that it's adapted from a novel by Romain Gary, who was a French author who wrote this book in 1970. Apparently, it's semi-grounded in his real-life experiences. Gary is an interesting figure who apparently pops up a lot when reading about old Hollywood. I'm sure we'll get the chance to give him a proper bio. But my understanding, I haven't read the book, but apparently structurally it's very similar. Only it turns out that the black dog trainer that is trying to reprogram the dog is also a militant Muslim who then deliberately and purposely trains him to attack whites instead and transplant his hatred, which I think had they gone with that, it would be a very different movie, and I think it would just be controversial, but not for any of the reasons that the final version of this film is.
Well, to say the least, I think there's no version of that story that could be told that wouldn't come off as deeply racist at the end of the day.
And fear-mongering as well. Given, like, the Nation of Islam and its emergence in America, through the post-war years onward. I mean, even 1982, you still have people like Louis Farrakhan on television and that. But, I mean, that's also not to say that the only reason that the changes are made is because the studio felt pressure. A lot of it came from Fuller himself. But, I mean, let me rewind a bit. So, in 1975, Paramount ends up acquiring the book rights. Curtis Hanson, who co-writes the script and would later go on to direct a very broad array of films, ranging from L.A. Confidential to Wonder Boys to 8 Mile. Became a very talented filmmaker in his own right, and I hope we get back to him sooner or later. But so there's the script that's in place, but then Paramount spends the next 7 years going through different co-writers, going through different directors, because no one can come up with a satisfying treatment of this story. And the legend has it that the Paramount studio executives, half of them wanted to make a sensitive and stirring look at race in America, and the other wanted to basically make a sequel to Cujo. And I mean, you can definitely see the seeds in the material of how that film could come about. But nothing ends up really happening until 1981-ish, because there's a looming union strike that's about to affect Hollywood, and Paramount, they go into damage control mode. So they look at all the scripts they have available to them, and they basically make a list, and they're like, what are the films that we can realistically finish and distribute before this strike comes into effect? And they realize White Dog is simple enough that it could be one of those films. And then Samuel Fuller's around, they ask him to direct it. He says, fine, as long as he gets to work on the script too, and off they go. Like, in a lot of respects, it is a very economical film. I think the budget was $7 million, I want to say, and it was shot in about 45 days, which is a pretty impressive turnaround, and I think you can definitely see where Fuller coming out of, like, the exploitation scene, where he brings that streamlined production approach, and... You know, certainly during a fraught time where nobody really knows what's going to happen in 2 months, having a guy that can bring a film in on time and under budget, definitely a selling point.
No, absolutely, that is the case. And, you know, so he goes off, he shoots the film, he puts together one hell of a cast for this thing. You have Christy McNichol, who... is probably a name that most people don't know now because she hasn't really worked since the late 90s. But in the 1970s, she was basically starts off as a child star and grows into trying to take on more challenging adult parts, and this is part and parcel of that. Unfortunately, she never quite was able to find material that would really push her to the forefront quite like this, certainly, again. But they also get the amazing Paul Winfield, and this is an actor who he's playing Keys, the role of the animal trainer that wants to deprogram the dog, who, again, at this point, has already come off playing Martin Luther King Jr. in the King miniseries of the 1970s. Many people will probably know him from being in Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, and Terminator. He's a much better actor than those films give him the ability to demonstrate. And if you want to see how good he is, this will be the movie to do it.
And I think it's 1972 or 73 that he's actually nominated for Best Actor for the film Sounder as well, which is a film about the history of a family of sharecroppers. And again, like, I haven't seen it. Part of me always thinks it's kind of suspect to go back to, like, the 1970s and revisit all these films that are heralded for being very important statements about race, much like we're doing here. But, I mean, at the same time, like, he is an actor that had a proven track record as a serious dramatic actor, and, yeah, I mean, like, honestly, growing up, I had no idea who he was other than the fact that he was the voice of Lucius Sweet on The Simpsons. And he deserves to be remembered for much more than that.
Yeah, most certainly that is the case. And then you got Burt Ives in the film, Jameson Parker, the already noted Paul Bartel in a very quick role, and even Sam Fuller himself popping up as a Hollywood agent on the behalf of the character that Christy McNichol plays in this movie. And, you know, the film gets put together. It's all sort of set. Fuller presents his final cut, and you're off to the races, right, Andrew? That's the case. This thing's set to be released and heralded and acclaimed.
Yeah. See, a funny thing happened on the way to theatrical distribution, because unbeknownst to Fuller, Paramount Paramount was very worried about what this film was going to turn out to be, and more importantly, as a business, they were worried about how audiences were going to respond to it. So without letting Fuller know, they hired two consultants from the NAACP to basically supervise production and then issue a report on whether or not the film was going to be controversial, which seems like the most bureaucratically backassward way of making sure you're not racist, but that's Hollywood for you. So the two reports that they get diverge. One of them says, nope, this film, it's sensitive, it's nuanced, it's fine. The other one says, no, this film is deeply problematic. So the film is slated to be released, and Paramount effectively, they just get cold feet. And they pull it from any kind of larger national run. I think, all told, it ended up running for a week or less in a couple major markets. I think Detroit was one of them. So if you look it up, I mean, this film made only about $30,000 in box office against a $7 million budget. But, like, that's not because this film flopped. It's because this film was shot in both knees and kicked out into the street. And it remained out of print for a very long time, aside from, like, festival showings and that. And Samuel Fuller ended up being so disenchanted with the whole process, he basically ended up spending the rest of his life in Europe. And White Dog is the last American studio film that he ever made. Years since, especially with festival circuits and specialized programming, as well as just sort of not necessarily reawakening, but the popularization of film journals and sort of the critical approach, Sam Fuller kind of gets rediscovered and reevaluated. Much like Howard Hawks, he sort of seen as a filmmaker that wasn't appreciated in his time, but even within the weird constraints of the forms he was working in, he does express a very distinct sensibility. And so currently, White Dog is now easier to find than ever before. There's a really good restoration, and yeah, that's the version that we're watching today. So I guess the question is, for a film that no one making it could decide whether or not it was controversial, I guess, what are the main themes that are at play here, Dave? I mean, because we can say it's a film about racism, but that doesn't really say anything by itself.
Well, the thing, effectively, the film, you can read it as an allegory, but the thing about it is I'm not sure that really entirely plays out, because the film, the allegory is so on the surface and very direct there. It feels more like text rather than subtext. So I'm a little hesitant to give it that, to say it's an allegory, but ostensibly the film is basically is posing a very direct question, which is, what do you do with racists and people who are racist? And, you know, also ultimately that gets into questions about how, you know, racism is, you know, sort of, you know, raised, I guess. I mean, basically people are end up being programmed or raised to hate somebody else, and the arbitrariness of that. And then fundamentally asking the question about, you know, number one, can you do anything about that? And number two, what does doing something about that look like? And ultimately, you know, is it even possible to permanently deal with the issue as such? And that is some heady territory to get into. And the film, again, because it's using the context of the idea of this dog that to as the sort of nature of the question. But the way in which Fuller does, and the way in which this film is structured, is very interesting, because the first 20 or so minutes, basically the film opens up with Christy McNichol's Julie, actress who's, I wouldn't say she's necessarily struggling to rise to the top, but she seems to be working. She has a house, this film. She has money to be able to.
She has a walk-on role of the nun.
Well, precisely. She has enough money to be able to live, we should say. The film opens straight up in the middle of the night with her having run this dog down in the street and taking it to the vet in order to heal it, because she doesn't know where it's come from. She doesn't know who the dog belongs to. And after being basically told, you know, that she's going to have to pay for this now and, you know, putting up these signs in order to try and find its original owners, she has zero luck. And the film sort of focuses on her kind of bonding with this dog for the first little while.
Yeah, and again, that's sort of very familiar territory. I mean, anyone who's ever seen Marley and Me or any kind of animal-centric film, I mean, those are familiar threads to hit, where circumstances force you together, and then we get that montage of like, oh no, you ate my shoes! But,
Yeah.
It's deployed to very different effect here. And I would say that by relying on those sort of stock conventions of this kind of animal-based filmmaking, that ends up actually being far more impactful in its own way. Because I think just to speak to something you said earlier, David, I think it may not be that this film is concerned as much with race. That isn't to say that this film negates it, because race is central to this film. And even it's released less than 20 years since the passage of the Civil Rights Act. So it's very much a live subject, and yeah, it's not subtext in this film as much as text. But I think it might be a broader question, where it's the idea of hatred in general, and sort of the question of, are we born innately knowing how to hate, or is it something that we are taught to do? And if we are taught to do it, is there any way we can unlearn it? And I think if we frame it in those terms, then, because not every Fuller film deals with matters of race, but I think it deals within its sort of critical look at America itself. I think it's more the question of, how do we understand and negotiate difference, and why is it that America seems to have such an enormous problem with doing that?
Well, no, you're not wrong. And I think, coming back to sort of the way in which this film's structured, the way Fuller does it, very deliberately, for about 20 or so minutes, it never comes up. And it's very clever the way in which he does this, because basically, when we say that she bonds the dog, what ends up happening is, because she lives up in the hills of Hollywood, and there's a scene early on with her and her screenwriting boyfriend basically saying, you know, if you don't want me to move in with you, you know, at least keep the dog around for protection. And that ends up being the case, because guess what? In the case of this bonding thing, it's not just, oh, you destroyed my shoes. It's dog basically stops attempted rapist.
Yeah, which again, going back to Eating Raoul, are you sure that we didn't just watch the same film twice? But yeah, so her home is broken into, she's attacked, and she is saved by the dog, who proceeds to jump out of a third-story window and attack this man from the air. And again, though, speaking to what you're going on about with how Fuller is very clever about it, it's that we read this scene in very superficial terms of, aw, the dog now loves her and it wants to protect her. And, you know, again, still very feel-good territory. But I think it's by relying on those conventions, Fuller is actively encouraging us to misidentify what's really going on here.
Well, it gets even more complicated from that, because there's something that really occurred to me watching the film this time through that I hadn't really picked up on the first time. And it's the way in which he structures this film is, for about the first 20 or so minutes, the only thing you see are white people. I mean, you know, Julie, her boyfriend, the police officers who arrive, the rapist himself, are all individuals. And then, you know, the dog goes missing chasing a rabbit, and Julie isn't able to find it. She goes listening. She ends up going to the pound. And the first time you see people who are, you know, not with a different skin pigmentation here is when she's at the pound, and they're all waiting to try and collect their animal, hoping that it's been picked up and that they can pick it up there. And there's very fascinating how you see this common humanity that's presented there, and the sort of shift that, you know, at this point in time, you know, if the film's not drawing attention to this being the sentiment where everybody's coming together, but again, you see both the hopes and dreams of people. You know, it's like, oh, we've been reunited with our pet. And, the pet not being found and not sure whether they're ever going to reclaim it. And Julie's just part of it. She's just, you know, she's like anybody else that's there. And then you cut to the follow-up scene.
Yeah, and that's where the film definitely turns its head and sort of reveals what this film actually is going to be about.
And basically what ends up happening is you cut to that night where the dog's still on the prowl away from Julie's home, comes across a sweet streeper being operated by a black worker, and it viciously attacks him and murders this man before returning to Julie. And she has no idea about this, but suddenly we, the audience, know.
Yeah, the dog comes home covered in blood, but I mean, it's not like it's holding the man's wallet. Julie, like any pet owner, just assumes that her dog has been hurt. And again, there's that sort of blindness at play here, where Julie doesn't really recognize what's happening, and then the dramatic irony is created, where we know something that the people on screen don't.
Absolutely. And you're just sort of, I mean, at this point, you know, all of a sudden we're reading this, you know, situation completely differently. And we end up at the scene where Julie goes on set for a role, playing a tourist, looking at a tourist in Italy as a flight attendant, along with another actress, a black actress. And Julie, for, you know, without anybody to take care of the dog, brings the dog to the set, which, okay, I will put aside the fact that I think that would probably be irresponsible regardless.
Yeah, you're making him head up and says, that dog isn't union, get him out of here.
Okay, so there is that side of it. But it's just like, yeah, I mean, if you're making a film, that dog starts barking, I am pretty sure at least one, you know, union worker is going to be furious with this thing, if not the director themselves. But sure enough, the dog spots the other actress and it unleashes itself at her. And suddenly Julie starts, you know, has this concern where she's reading it, says, oh no, my dog's, you know, viciously attacking people. What am I going to do? And she still has a, you know, she still doesn't recognize this dog has been explicitly trained to do something. So she's just looking for any help to prevent having to put the dog down.
Well, yeah. And even up until, you know, in sort of in desperation, she starts turning to different animal trainers. And that's when she meets Carruthers and Keyes, played by Burl Ives and Paul Winfield, respectively, who are basically showbiz animal trainers. But even through that first conversation, she, as far as she knows, the problem isn't that, you know, the dog, who is never named, the dog, she doesn't see it as the dog is trained to go after people of color. She just thinks, well, it's a German Shepherd. It must have been bred to be an attack dog, and I need to rehabilitate it. And it's only after she meets the trainers and, despite being muzzled, still tries to maul one of the workers there, only then does Carruthers sort of figure it out for her and explains that he's a white dog. And that means something very different and has its own very specific history. And that only occurs probably about halfway through the film.
It's probably about the 30, 35 minute mark, which, so a little bit before the halfway point, but certainly, you know, it's, the film hasn't, it takes its time, you know, finally twisting the knife into our character where they recognize what's going on. And of course, at this point, Julie starts doing the understandable thing of asking, well, what on earth are you talking about? You know, how do you, could this even happen? Which, this is kind of brilliant in the way in which it's done, because the film very explicitly underlines the fact that Julie is, it, okay, let me back up for a second before I go down this road. The way in which this film is structured, and this might be, I think, probably the most problematic element of it, looking at this particularly in the light of, you know, 2018 and how cultures shifted and changed, is this is a film that, for all its nuance, is directed very much at a white audience.
Yes.
Julie is our point of view character. She's our entry point into it. And she's the one that's asking the questions and having to reconcile the fact that there is an entire history of atrocities that she's completely ignorant, not only completely ignorant of, but she can't even recognize that it's going on in contemporary times. And, you know, once Keyes enters the film, which, again, as you sort of noted, Andrew, in that magnificent shot where Paul Winfield is given this amazing, there's a zoom in on the name Keyes on the
on the sign over the driveway, and then it just slowly pans down to Paul Winfield, like, occupying the full frame, just walking with determination. And it's such a weird little shot, but, I mean, like, I think that's a Sam Fuller special right there.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is, it's very much playing into the sort of pulpy and, sort of vibe of it, but my God, does it work. But the thing is once Keyes enters the film, the interesting thing is the nature of the film sort of shifts, because at this point, everybody is pushing for this dog to be put down, because it's like, what are you going to do about this? This thing needs to be killed and eliminated. Yeah, and
Carruthers, his reaction is like, once a dog, whether it's an attack dog or a white dog, it's once they're programmed to do this, they can't be deprogrammed. And he tells that offhanded little anecdote about animal trainer friend of his who raised a German Shepherd that was an attack dog, and after 9 years of being best friends, the dog one day just ripped his throat out. And so there's the idea that we can't guarantee that the dog is never going to attack anyone, so we have to destroy it because it's the only way to be certain.
And at this point, you know, Keyes enters the scene, and recognizing what this is, he decides that, okay, I'm going to take 5 weeks vacation, and I am going to try and reprogram this dog. This will be my mission, and if it does not work, I'll put it down myself. This thing. And what we slowly come to understand, number one, is that A, this is not the first time Keyes has done this, as the film eventually makes very explicit. He's tried this twice before, and it's failed both times, despite his best efforts. And, two, there's... I wrote it down in notes as almost an Ahab-like obsession he has with doing this, but I think that gives that simplifies the morality of what's going on in a way that I don't intend it to.
It's difficult. And I mean, I think as we go through the plot, it might be a bit more clear why it's not quite as simple as, well, he simply won't stop believing in goodness inside of all things. Because I don't think it's nearly as reductive as that. And certainly by the conclusion, there is no easy or pat answer. But at least for our purposes, Keyes introduces himself as, well, I'm going to take on that challenge. And even though he's not giving his reasons why, Julie, at least she knows someone's willing to try and do something. And this way there's a chance that she doesn't have to have the dog put down. So what does she have to lose, right?
Well, yeah, and I think what's very clever, again, you know, credit where credit's due here, the way in which this film works, I mean, the film never paints it like Julie is anything less than ignorant, because one of the first scenes she has with Keyes, he's explaining the history of white dogs and how this became a thing. You know, how is it that you could train a dog specifically to do this? And he goes through the history of how this started off as, you know, ways in which slave masters used to track down runaways, and then how prisons and police used it to track down black convicts. Yeah. And Julie has this line where it's like, what about white convicts? And the look that on Key's face when she asks that, where it's just the recognition of just how naive she is.
He doesn't say anything. He just gives her this look that says it all. And again, it's not like, you know, an eye roll or, oh my God. It's just that look of understanding. And yet, like, it's in that look, he's basically communicating. He's like, well, that's right. You are naive and you don't know this. And what Julie doesn't recognize is that because she's a white person living in Hollywood, she doesn't have to know this, right? And I mean, it goes back to the argument over privilege where, you know, I've met many people who deny the idea of white privilege. And because they're like, well, you know, it's never benefited me. And then you have to break it down and explain it to people. Well, the main privilege is that you don't have to think of yourself as an other. You know, you don't have to think about the history of slavery in America. You don't have to think about racialization in modern society. Like, that is the ultimate privilege. And in that moment, like, it's so interesting in 2018 that this film kind of anticipates that response. And I mean, that may also be because that response certainly isn't a modern creation. But, you know, Keyes, to his credit, he doesn't scold her, he doesn't lecture her, but he just gives her that look that signals, I understand you, but you are never totally going to understand me.
Exactly, and it's very fascinating. I can't remember whether this precedes that conversation or happens after, but there's the scene where she visits the other actor that was attacked by her dog in the hospital, and that actor basically says, like, look, it's an accident, these things happen, it's like, who knows what triggered it, and it's like, you don't know, and Julie just flat out lies, saying, I don't know what triggered it, and there's this, it's very sinister, the way in which she's basically, she knows the answer, she can very explicitly explain what has happened at this point, to her about why the dog attacked her, and she chooses not to. And again, the film really questions, is it a matter of guilt? Is it a matter of she doesn't know how to process it or explain it? And the film never really lets her off the hook for that, because it's not that Julie is a bad person per se. She's just, she's ineffective and unsure about anything. Yeah.
Dealing with both animal training and race in America, two subjects that she has really no frame of reference for. And I mean, yeah, like, the other thing I think that's worth noting, especially at this point, is this film handles its characters in an interesting way, in that, like, Julie is sort of our point of entry and sort of the main through line, but we don't really get much insight into her as a character, her experience, her lived reality. But we don't really get it from anybody else either. So the film gives us just enough, and largely through the performances as well, where it opens up all of these questions and allows us just enough to realize that, well, Julie is also clearly having some difficulty sort of, like, acknowledging, like, the nature of her dog. But we're also not given enough information that we can resolve it in any kind of satisfying way. And I think through and through, like, this film is very interested in raising questions, but every time you think that you can come to a conclusion, it sort of detours or pokes at the idea and resists that kind of pat answer.
Well, no, absolutely. And what's interesting is, at this point, we're sort of about halfway through the film, and we've already raised some pretty challenging notions, but you would think that the majority of the film is then going to focus on the rehabilitation of this dog, and to a degree, or attempted rehabilitation of this dog.
Like, love and togetherness triumphs over everything, right? Standard 1980s movie.
And you might think that, but that's not quite the way things go. Because certainly, we see Keyes at work. We see him trying to wear the dog down in a situation where basically he makes himself a target for the dog in this padded gear that prevents him from getting actually hurt. But the attempt is to wear the dog down so it doesn't, eventually it's too tired and will catch on to the idea that there's no benefit from attacking him whatsoever.
Yeah, that its anger is ultimately useless. And just building up the idea that, well, no matter how much you may hate me, you can't hurt me.
Precisely. And, okay, that's an interesting thing. And there's probably a good movie that could be made just exploring that for a while. However, what really shifts the film, and I think is probably the point which makes it really the challenging part, is that during the segment of the film, the dog escapes. It works its way back into the city. And in a brilliantly executed sequence of tension, you see the dog prowling streets, you see a black child on the street, the dog is just around the corner from it. It's not seeing him, he's just around there, and you're sitting there waiting, oh my god, is this dog, will it spot this kid, can this be prevented? And mercifully, the tension, it's all done in one shot, but you see quickly a parent or teacher or whoever comes in and, you know, brings the child back into the into the building, so the dog never catches it.
And but with what Morricone's ends up score underneath it, though, the music starts swelling, and, you know, say what you will, but a film composer like Ennio Morricone, if they know anything, it's they know how to deploy their music to effect. And all those sequences of the dog wandering and just sort of alternating, like, point of view from the dog's eyes, especially because we're denied language or any kind of any real direction in these scenes. Like, the music fills in the gap, and it just gives us those eerie strings, and we feel like everything is going to go sideways at every moment.
Absolutely. But what this sequence does ultimately end up building to is he ends up spotting another black man walking the street, viciously chases him down into a church where he proceeds to kill him. And at this point, Key shows up, too late to do anything, tranquilizes the dog, puts it in there, recognizes what has happened, and then decides to cover it up. By basically taking the dog back and explaining.
And Carruthers and Julie also agree to cover it up as well.
Yeah, and this leads to just a great, beautiful acting set piece for Paul Winfield, where he gets back and he explains that, yeah, the dog has killed someone. And when Julie turns around, it's like, well, we got to put the dog down now. I mean, we have to. He, you know, goes down and basically says, that's your solution. That's the best thing you've got is, we're going to do it. It's like, no, we're going to keep at this. I can't experiment on a dead dog. You know, I can't figure this out if we kill it. And basically, saying, it's like, I'm just going to keep doing this. Even if we fail this time, I'll keep doing it again and again and again until I crack it. Because, you know,
well,
and go ahead. You go ahead.
Well, it's just. His immediate reaction, though, and that whole scene, you know, it's like, this is a film that's largely without dialogue for very long stretches, but, oh man, the monologue that Winfield gives here, like, and the despair in his voice, it's powerful, and he's doing a number of different things all at the same time, and it all works, but his first visceral reaction is, oh, you just want to kill the dog? And what does he say? Something to the effect of, so you're really just like everybody else. And that line there is interesting because, you know, the same way that, you know, I remember a couple years ago, shortly after Barack Obama was elected president, my girlfriend at the time watched The View every morning. And yeah. I remember the hostesses talking about the idea of race in America, and three out of the four being like, no, racial divisions are still a problem. And Elizabeth Hasselbeck, who is white, ended up like breaking out in tears because like she was just so horrified by the idea that, well, what do you mean? We elected a black president, so how can you tell me that racism is a thing? And the idea that it's easier to just shunt it away and disavow it, I mean, that's easy, and I feel like that's what Keyes is sort of reacting against. The idea that, let's just pretend that it doesn't exist. Whereas what he's trying to say is, like, I'm actually trying to do whatever I can to solve this problem. And just, you know, pulling a bullet in the dog and dumping it in an incinerator, well, that gets rid of the dog, but that doesn't get rid of the problem. And I think that's sort of another turning point in the film, where, again, we're never given a huge backstory for Keyes or why he has, like, this Sisyphean interest in redeeming and rehabilitating the dog. But we at least understand what he's against. And, like, that, I don't know, it's a very powerful scene. And it's one that makes you kind of uncomfortable because all of a sudden every character's motivation seems to be upended a little bit. And this is the first moment we see Keyes, like, really passionately react to something. And we're left with that sense of, well, I have to do something because the rest of the world is content doing nothing.
You're not wrong. No, absolutely. And I think the thing that really becomes intriguing about the film and challenging is the fact that, on one hand, you're completely identifying with Keyes and what he wants to achieve, but you're also recognizing the fact that what he's basically proposing and what he's doing at this point is going to put people in immediate danger. if he does not succeed, and if there isn't, if he does not have success. And that's a challenging thing. The idea of the immediate safety for all versus the fact that, yeah, no, this kind of problem takes long, torturous work to solve. Ultimately, it's difficult. And the film sort of from that point forward, we're at like an hour into this movie and there's only about 30 minutes left, but that now hovers over the rest of the film, where our trio of heroes, as it were, and I don't want to, or protagonists, because I don't want to use that term, because I don't, again, very reductive in its use here.
Yeah. This are is now, a film that features people, not heroes.
Yeah. And, yeah, but in this case, they're now complicit in covering up a crime. And there's a great sequence shortly afterwards when, you know, as they're seeming to have some breakthroughs here, they end up having a dinner at Carruthers' place with Keys and Julie and them all there, and the police show up, and they're just looking for directions to where they're trying to get, and they've all been sort of having this jovial meal, and suddenly, you know, you can tell, like, all three of them recognize they had the exact same fear and fear and discomfort at what they thought was about to happen. And suddenly there's self-justification, particularly from Carruthers, where it's like, well, we all know we're doing the right thing. And yet the law wouldn't understand and that. And it's so, the film never paints them that as anything other than self-justification in terms of what's going on. And it's a really uncomfortable scene. Because, yeah, these
three, doing a lot of wrong things in the service of the right thing.
But not only that, but the fact that they're having a meal. They are technically at least performing the idea of enjoying themselves while doing it. And yeah, in the back of your head, a man who is just walking down the street is dead. And you've denied anybody any sort of, you know, recognition as to what happened to him and why this happened. And who, I mean, obviously this guy probably has family and friends who are wondering what on earth took place here. And yeah, you've covered it up. I mean, the film never ultimately revisits that. It's not like that becomes a plot point hovering over the entire film in which everything hinges, but it really is, you know, this sort of uncomfortable gray moral territory that we've entered into. But at this point, you know,
and
certainly
again, though, I think that's firmly within Samuel Fuller's oeuvre as a filmmaker. You know, because again, it would be so easy to just come down on one side and say, oh, well, it turns out the dog can be redeemed, or no, it can't be. But this film never really goes to either extreme, and instead it seems more content to stay in the middle, and maybe it's because issues like this can't be resolved that neatly in real life, and Fuller at least is self-aware enough, or at least understands America well enough that he's not going to bother giving, like, that pablum to the audience.
No, absolutely. And and this sort of brings us to, as the film goes on, Keys seems to be having some degree of success. Finally, you know, the dog isn't attacking him, and then ultimately another black man he brings in to help assist him just to test and see whether he'll be attacked. He has success there. So it looks like the film is building towards this idea that, okay, moral gray questions aside, maybe there, you know, maybe this moral lapse or oversight on their part can actually be justified with this.
Or the idea that maybe the larger problem of hatred can't be solved, but at least individuals can be redeemed. You know, it's we can't end racism, but maybe there's hope for individual racists.
And the thing that's intriguing is, again, one of the very unique things is when they start explicitly going into how dogs like the dog in question here are trained, you know, it's because the dog is basically victimized at first. I mean, they are basically beaten by individuals as part and parcel of trying to generate hate on them. So the film very explicitly paints the dog as both a perpetrator but also victim of the system that it's been caught in here. And this leads to probably the most disturbing scene and fascinating scene of the film, which is he's having thought that he's had success. Carruthers convinces him, it's like, look, you should call Julie and tell her, because it's like, you know, what else can you do to prove that this works? And he does so, and Julie goes rushing out of the house, out of her house, to get down there to see, you know, that maybe this dog has finally been saved. And she suddenly encounters the original owner of the dog. And again, in a masterstroke, it's not, to Fuller here, they don't present, the owner isn't a cartoon villain or blatant obvious individual. It is
he's not Peter Boyle in Monsters Ball, you know? It's not like he shows up at her door in a Klan hood or anything like that. Instead, it's a kindly old grandfather with his grandchildren and a box of chocolates as a thank you for finding the dog.
And the direction in this scene, the camera work, the performances involved are so good. Because basically, Julie's ready to take off until he reveals that, you know, we're there to get the dog. And she slowly turns around and she just has this very straightforward question of, did you train the dog? And it's like, yep, I did it. And, you know, there's this brilliant, you know, close-up of Christy McNichol's face. And she doesn't turn her head. You just see her glance down to the side to side where the grandchildren of this old man are beside him there. And she immediately bluntly asks, you trained him to be a white dog. And the look on his face is he has to process how to answer that question. And then gleefully admits, I trained him to be the best there is.
Yeah, and even prior to that, when she says, did you train that dog? He says, yep, since he was a puppy. And that comes back to Keyes earlier and him explaining that the younger, the better. If you teach dogs to be afraid of black people or other people of color, that's how the process begins. So in that, like, he tips his hand before he even says anything.
Exactly. And, you know, the film at this point, I mean, Fuller is very clearly underscoring the sort of one-to-one analog between what this guy did to the puppy and then looking at these children and recognizing, you know, he's probably not just, you know, who else's other's heads is he filling with all of this, filling with racist hate? And, you know, Julie, in a moment that is probably one of the more complicated scenes of the film, unleashes on him, basically, you know, chewing him up, calling him out for, you know, the horrors he's done and what a monster he is. And it's a fascinating scene because on one hand, you kind of feel the sort of righteous anger that she has towards him. You know, this fact that she recognizes what he's done and what horrors have happened because of him. And there's even a sort of like a...
She's not taking the response of just, like, nodding and smiling politely and shuffling away. Like, you know, whenever anybody goes for Thanksgiving and the one relative has had a few too many and starts talking about, you know, the way it really is, and everyone just rolls their eyes and says, okay, well, I won't have to deal with this till next year. Like, Julie doesn't stay silent here. You know, she gives him exactly what's on her mind and caps it off by saying, and by the way, your dog has been deprogrammed by a black trainer. But, yeah, I mean, I think you're going in that direction, but is this satisfying to the viewer?
Well, this is the thing, because on one hand, you can tie into takes while there is pleasure to be taken in how she's sort of throwing it in his face about this. There's also the recognition that ultimately there are several points that I think complicate it very telling, which is number one, he is not going to face justice for what he's caused. Because to do so, there's a moment where he says he'll go to the police and Julie tells him, well, yeah, you go to the police and you explain what's going on. And I'll explain, you know, we'll show him how you've trained a white dog. And on one hand, you get the sense like, yeah, you know, you caught him in his moral trap. But at the same time, you're complicit in covering up his crimes. And
Julia doesn't exactly have the moral high ground. I mean, in a true sense here.
Exactly. And ultimately it comes down to all she can do is yell at him and attack him, but she's not solving the problem. And anyway, there's no, like, there's no winning in this scenario, other than maybe hoping that his young daughter or young granddaughters will listen to what she's saying. And that's very unlikely, given how she's behaving and the fact that this is, you know, this woman's screaming at grandpa, what's going on? You know, do they have the ability to even comprehend what's happened here? And
at best, she's redirecting this old man's hate back towards him, which ends up being echoed in a much more disturbing way in the scene to follow. But I mean, there's that sense of like, it's a reaction that it walks a very fine line, and I'm worried that does tip into sort of over-the-top territory, but I almost feel like that in itself is a deliberate move as well. Because the same way that Julie seems unable to comprehend the history of race and sort of the history of canines being used as weapons to subordinate people of color, like, I think it's the same naivete that makes her ignorant about all the about this lived history. It's that same naivete that has her see this old man and think, okay, well, because the dog didn't attack two black people this morning, problem solved. And, like, she's triumphant in his face. Like, she is about to hang up a banner that says mission accomplished. But I think the fact that she takes it as a victory based off, you know, just what she's seen, like, it's so simplistic in her mind that her response is to basically, like, dust her hands and say, well, that about wraps it up for that. And it's never that simple.
No, absolutely not. And that's the thing. I mean, it really is, it really does ring hollow. And I think one of the wonderful things about the music at this point is it's foreshadowing the fact that, yeah, no, this isn't going to go the way she thinks it is. And yeah, this leads us to the climactic scene where Julie gets to witness, yes, the dog will not attack, seems to have stopped attacking people based on the color of their skin. There's then a moment of tension where it looks like maybe the dog's coming to attack Julie, but it doesn't.
Yeah, and then because it recognizes her as its owner.
Yeah, and then Carruthers walks in. And at this point, the dog snaps and attacks at him, and despite all his best efforts, Keyes has no choice but to kill the dog. So ultimately, we're left with a film in which, yeah, all the self-justification of covering up the death of, or how this man died, or one of the victims of the white dog early in the film has died, are all for naught. And again, in a very fascinating choice, as the end credits roll, because again, one of the things that the film, or that's sort of underscored early in the film, is the idea is the fact that dogs see in black and white. They don't see in color. And the credits slowly, the color fades out of the scene as the camera pulls back just from this overhanging shot of defeat on everybody. Mm-hmm. And like I said, it's such a very stark, uncomfortable, uncompromising ending in terms of, well, what else, I mean, what solution does this film come to? And ultimately it's that it doesn't have a solution really to offer. It doesn't, well, it poses questions, and it doesn't know.
And correct me if I'm wrong though, that whole climactic scene, is there any dialogue? Because I'm trying to remember, and, like, I'm not sure there's anything more than, like, incidental dialogue there. Like, it's not that they shoot the dog, and then they all sadly reflect and say, oh, well, you know, we could teach it to no longer hate black skin, but instead it just started hating white skin. Like, there's never that moment where any kind of statement is made, or any of the characters reflect on a lesson learned. Like, Fuller places that responsibility squarely on the viewer. And again, I'm like, well, you're giving audiences a lot of credit there and a lot of trust as well, especially given how harrowing that scene is as it plays out. And I mean, the fact that we have those sort of misdirections where the dog, as it's running, certainly looks like it's about to attack, only for everything to be fine. And then when we think everything's okay, that's when it attacks. So there's multiple different shifts with our expectations there, but we're also denied any kind of diegetic commentary on it. And yeah, I think if any moment really makes emblematic what Fuller's trying to do here, I mean, it's got to be this one, because he doesn't hold your hand and he doesn't wrap it up. And even if he is giving like a negative or a pessimistic message, he's still not making that clear. Instead, it's up to us to decode what's on screen.
Well, that's the thing. And the funny thing is, the first time I ever watched this film, it was back in the early 2000s, because a high school teacher of mine had taped it. Somehow, I don't know who was playing this on television, but he managed to tape it off of it. And he showed it to our class. And, you know, he was very firm in his belief that the allegorical reading is that the only thing you can ultimately do, and that Fuller was reaching, is that the idea is that you have to put racists down. And I think that's really reductive to what Fuller is trying to do. But I would certainly say that Fuller is... I think it's ultimately Fuller kind of admitting it's like he's not 100% positive that there's a perfect fix or anything that can be really achieved, particularly, you know, and certainly not without an incredibly heavy amount of work on everybody's part to do that. Yeah, and
a lot of unsatisfying compromises as well.
Exactly. And that's the thing. Like, I mean, this is not a film that you don't get out of the theater having watched this movie or after watching it on video and think, wow, I'm uplifted. No, you come out and it's like, well, the world is horrible, and, you know, I don't know whether it's ever going to get better. And it's kind of fascinating looking, you know, again, this film comes out in 82. We're closing in on 40 years of this film having been around. And honestly, has the world actually gotten any better?
I mean, I don't think you and I are equipped to answer that question, because, again, we don't have that lived experience. I mean, in a lot of ways, we are Julie. You know, we can go off what we learn from others, but there's never that innate position of authority that we can speak from. And I think that's also... I think in a lot of ways, though, like, we are the audience that Fuller's intending the film for. Where it's easy for us to be like, oh, well, prejudice is bad. Everybody should be treated equal. But then having to negotiate those ideals against everyday lived existence, suddenly it becomes a lot more complicated. And I mean, by the ending of this film as well, like, it causes us to sort of reevaluate a number of things that happened previously. Because, like, Carruthers and the vet and everyone who says, oh, that dog is dangerous and needs to be put down, well, it turns out that they were right. And it turns out that Keyes, who presumably, like, we have the most amount of sympathy for, him and Julie, who believe that it is possible to unlearn and learn new habits and a different way to be, well, it turns out that in this case, they're wrong as well. And even the earlier scenes, you know, we're really forced to revisit, where it's like, oh, so that first home defense, you know, we see it as a moment of bonding when really it's our first signal of the violence that's brewing within this dog at all times. And, you know, the ending just becomes so destabilizing that there really is no concrete takeaway other than whatever you think about race in America, it is far more complicated than that.
Well, precisely. And I think
that's an important message to make, though, especially working out of Hollywood, where even now, I mean, like, representation, I think, has gotten more nuanced over time. But at the same time, you know, you see how a film like Moonlight, I mean, yes, it won Best Picture, you know, but not before La La Land gave it a run for its money. But at the same time, for every film like Moonlight some of Spike Lee's earlier work, like Do the Right Thing, that really explore questions of, like, black identity in America, We also have films like Red Tails, or we have films like Hidden Figures, where it's just, it sort of elides a lot of history and sort of mythologizes it as well, it turns out that, you know, during World War II, black people were just as patriotic and they made just as many sacrifices, so let's remember them and forget all the bad parts. I mean, this is the idea that there has to be a simple and straightforward answer and solution to the problematics of race. Hollywood still proposes that in the majority of, like, black-centric narratives, and it's only been, like, you know, on the art house circuit or films like Get Out, maybe, as a recent example. You know, it's only recently that we're starting to even acknowledge that it is a complicated issue, let alone end on a note of such destabilization as this one.
Well, and I think this sort of brings it to a very interesting point about this film, and returning to a point where I said one of the more problematic things is that this is a film that I think Fuller very explicitly is making for a white audience overall. And it's the fact that this is a film that comes out in 1982, just as new black cinema is, you know, firmly galvanizing into, for lack of better, into a thing. It's becoming, you know, we're getting Spike Lee coming onto the scene. Robert Townsend's starting to come onto the scene. The Hughes brothers are arriving onto the scene. And it's really, you start getting films, yeah, like Do the Right Thing, which are very explicitly from a black perspective and made for, you know, again, anybody can see him, but I think it's hard not to look at what Spike Lee's doing and recognizing he's making for a black audience. Very explicitly. And it raises the question of, if this movie were to be made today, would you choose, I mean, assume, let's just assume Sam Fuller, through the magic of time travel, has ended up in, you know, 2018, and would make the exact same movie as he did now that he did then, would I probably select him to do it? And the answer would be no. I don't think he, you know, for all the credit we can give him here, I don't think that would be the right call now. And it might even be, and again, it is even the question, was it the right call in 82? I mean, and that's a tough question to sort of grapple with, because yeah, there's no question that Fuller, you know, is an intelligent filmmaker, but he's bringing all his gifts to bear on this film and wants desperately to do the right thing by it. And by all, I think most measurements, he succeeds. But given the subject matter, should he be the one telling that story, period? And I honestly don't have an answer for that. Because I would say I'm leaning towards no.
I would disagree with you, Dave.
Okay.
Because I think that Fuller would still be capable of making this film, provided that we understand what this film is actually designed to do. And as long as really the ultimate message of the film is, hey, privileged audience, did you know that you have no idea what you're talking about and there are no simple answers to any of the issues you want to weigh in on? You know, if that's the message, then I think that's fine. And I think Fuller is a person that can deliver that. Whereas if you're trying to use this plot setup to talk about how, I don't know, maybe if it focuses more on Keys, or if it's trying to purport to reflect like an authentic black experience within America, you know, air quotes around that, because I mean, nothing is that archetypal. Then I would say someone like Fuller probably is the wrong one. But if we see it as a film that's basically trying to challenge sort of the white rightness and the idea that, oh, well, don't worry, we'll think about it for a few minutes and we'll figure out a solution that'll work for everyone. You know, as long as you view this film in the context of pushing back against that mentality, then I think it works. But at the same time, the fact that even almost 40 years later, like you and I are still going back and forth over what this movie is even really trying to say. I mean, it's an easy film to describe. It is a difficult film to understand. And that's not to say that by the end of this discussion, you and I are going to concretely solve what this film really is. And I think, but the very fact that we're left in this sort of tenuous position and sort of floating between possibilities, I mean, I think that is a signal that this is a film more about pushing against and sort of being that contrary opinion than necessarily offering anything positivistic. And, I mean, going off of last week's discussion, I don't necessarily think that's a problem either. Because I think 1982 white audiences, it is important to remind them that there are some things that they have no clue what they're talking about.
You're not wrong. I guess my question, the way I see it, is, you know, it's the idea of personal action as it reflects the values you're proposing in your work. And again, that's not, I mean, I think Fuller, by all accounts, is somebody who did everything in his power to walk the walk, as it were, as best he could. I'm just wondering whether ultimately the recognition that, given it that the subject matter's place historically in America, in Black culture and history specifically, whether it would ultimately be right for him to use it as a subject matter at all. And that, I mean, yes, I completely agree with you. You know, certainly what he's doing is unquestionably a positive thing overall. It's just, does he get the right then to tap into that? And I honestly, I don't have a clear answer to how to that, because I don't know. I honestly don't know what would be the right thing at this point.
Well, I think the film circumvents that because it's sort of abstracted. Like, this is not a film that purports to comment on the Black experience in America. You know, it's not necessarily depicting realities. And like, going back to the thinness of the characters, like, everybody has those little details that suggest there's like, that they do have, like, actual lives and histories that we're not privy to. And, like, there's that sense of lived-in-ness. But in terms of developing its characters, like, that's not what the film is really interested here. And, you know, I guess in that respect, I think looking at the more philosophical, abstract idea of hatred in general, as opposed to racism as a specific, narrowed version of that, I think that's how Fuller kind of gets a pass here, only because, you know, the moment that you go from, I want to interrogate the idea of hatred and tolerance, to all of a sudden saying, I want to make a film about the difficulty of, you know, white and Black integration in America following the 1970s, then it becomes something very different, and then questions of, whose story are you telling? Is this your story to tell? Then those questions become a lot more front and center. Does that make sense?
I see what you're getting at. I mean, I would want, it's something we're not going to settle tonight. I mean, it's something I would want to ponder over because, and by all means, if anybody has thoughts, that they would like to contribute.
Clearly me and David need some people to weigh in on this one.
Yeah, certainly I would be fascinated to hear what everybody has to say because I don't know. I mean, it's one of those things where there is, even as I agree with you, there is a degree of hesitancy on my part. And again, I'm saying this as somebody who admires the hell out of the film. Obviously, I think that's much has been made clear here. But yeah, I mean, again, I think that just sort of cuts to the heart of how complicated and unclear the issues themselves are.
This is a film that, by all accounts, seems very superficial and is vastly more complex in its telling. And, you know, I mean, this film is designed to be that structurally. So I think maybe the fact that you and I can't come to a clear answer means that the film succeeds then? I mean, I think the only reason that Fuller would see us as, like, not getting his film is if we came out of the theater being like, all right, well, let's start executing all the white racists, you know? I don't think this is a film that intends to lead us to one position. And again, like, it's because so much is at the level of, you know, straddling between text and subtext. And even, you know, I realize now we're in 20 in, like, there's more aspects that do complicate even what we've read so far. Like, Do you think that it's completely coincidental that the black trainer is named Keys, and yet there are so many shots, especially in the final third of the film, that's just him and the dog in a cage, like circling one another? And yet, even though his name is Keys and like the idea of being freed from shackles, he ultimately fails in his project to do that. Like, the moment you start incorporating any of the textual cues in this film, whatever reading you think you have also becomes more complicated. And so, it's weird because again, like I don't want to just let it lie at, well, this is a film that designs or it is designed to resist any kind of reading, because I don't think that's fundamentally true about most films. I think usually if a director says that or like, well, this isn't a film for critics, that's just a cop out to say, well, I made a terrible movie, but that's okay because nobody reads Vincent Canby anymore. It's just, and like, there's a lot more with Julie and just like sort of her socialization through the film that, well, even though she means well, she also happens to live a life that's very segregated, as you brought up. And just, like, this definitely is a film designed to be studied, I think.
Well, it's the thing. I would. This is certainly. It's such a rich text and one worth. I would say guided study of this film with younger viewers would be a fascinating experience. I mean, and by younger, I mean teenagers and above. Like, I don't think that this is a film that anyone below that age would probably be able to really start grappling with. Intellectually, in the way I think it needs to be, but certainly no, I would certainly agree, go with you on that, and I think that's kind of a good place to sort of leave off the main conversation, because I think we've hit upon the real crux of this, what's going on in this film, and the sort of complicated reactions that it's likely to provoke in its viewing. And certainly I think the fact that it is remains a relevant text in 2018 is I honestly don't have anything I can say to that, because I don't know what to say to that, but
Well, yeah, it may not necessarily be like a prescriptive film in that there's a clear message that it wants the audience to take away, and it's still a problematic film in the sense that we have white directors and screenwriters and top billed actress, guiding us through a story about racism, and I think that's dicey. As time goes on, we understand even more reasons why that's dicey. But at the same time, I think it's an important film. It's weird to say that about a film that literally nobody saw when it got released, but I think as long as the issue of race is debated in modern media discourse and modern critical studies, I mean, I think this film remains relevant, if and only if, because this is that counterpoint to anybody who thinks that they figured it out. Or, like the joke in Fritz the Cat, anybody who thinks that, well, I think I understand, the immigrant experience in America because I took a semester of social studies. There's always going to be much more than you can possibly encapsulate into an argument. And this film is an effective reminder of that. And along with that, it means that, well, as much as we try to disavow and deny, slavery and racial segregation, they are major, major factors in how North America, not just America, but how the modern civilized world developed into what it is today. And even though like it's easy to disavow outright racism in that, well, most of us are like Julie, where we have no problem living in a system that provides us with benefits structured on the backs of centuries of horrendously racist behavior. I don't know. It's this film is an interesting it's a very interesting and well-made articulation of reminding us that we really don't know nothing about nothing.
Yeah. On that,
Yeah, on a
on
jauntier note,
that,
why
hits
don't
and
we end with our yes, hits and pits? That's always good for a laugh.
yeah.
So yeah, who now trying to think about a hit after all that? Do you have for the uninitiated, Hits and Pits, not quite a recap. We just try to highlight the smaller moments and the little details that either made us smile or drove us insane. So, Dave, I had the pick this week. Do you want to lead us off with a hit?
In terms of this film, as you can have probably figured out, there's not a ton of humor in it, by any stretch of the imagination. This is a rather somber work. But it's hard not to admire the way in which Carruthers seems to have a desperate hate for R2-D2 and George Lucas in general. which, I mean, boy, in the back of my mind, when he starts talking about, you know, his fears and paranoias about how robots are going to replace animals and animal trainers, man, is he going to really hate it when the words CGI come up.
I mean, our introduction, it's Burl Ives angrily pointing at an R2-D2 dartboard, saying, "See that? That blinking piece of tin? Remember this, because in 30 years, there won't be any animals anymore." It's this weird moment of levity, and, you know, it also signals, well, this is what some people consider a problem.
It's weird in this otherwise somber film. But I think by that point, people did probably need kind of a chuckle, I guess, to alleviate the dourness and tension of this movie. But, so there's a hit. What about you, Andrew? Anything that we haven't highlighted so far that you would like to note for our listeners?
I would say... I mean, this isn't a beautiful film. Like, this isn't shot by Roger Deakins or anything like that. Like, there's sort of a graininess and, like, a low-fidelity quality to it. Almost like a haziness. But I would like to say Bruce Surtees, who is the cinematographer on this film, from what I've been able to find, he worked very closely with Clint Eastwood. He was director of photography on The Beguiled, Play Misty for Me, Dirty Harry... so he's kind of well-versed in making L.A. look very grim and washed out, but here I think it's employed a very interesting thematic effect, because that overall muddiness just goes along so well with the thematic core of the film. But I will say, like, there are sequences, like, especially when the dog is out, and, you know, we have absolutely no verbal cues to go off of. The interchange of, like, the close-ups and sort of the match on sight with the point of view shots and the way it's edited, it's very effective at, you know, because it denies us language, all of a sudden everything becomes a terrifying possibility, and that takes a certain degree of skill and craftsmanship to pull off, so kudos to him. Is there another hit from you, Dave?
You know what? We've praised this individual quite a bit throughout this episode, but once again, I gotta give it up for Paul Winfield. Like, Hollywood failed him, utterly failed him, because this guy should have been, you know, a leading man, or at least getting quality parts in, you know, big screen ensembles throughout his entire career. And the fact that, you know, I was just. Again, what are the films that people remember him for? You know, he's the dude who, you know, sacrifices himself to make sure that James Kirk lives in Wrath of Khan. That's the role we're going to remember from? I love him in that movie. Don't get me wrong. But this man, you know, should have had better material to pick from over the years.
Yeah, but Wrath of Khan also made more than $20,000 at the box.
It is true, but I mean, it's just, again, this is a guy who, towards the end of his career, again, he's popping up in episodes of Touched by an Angel. And look, I know the show has its fans, I'm not knocking it, but I think even they would have to admit that Touched by an Angel is not the high barometer mark for artistic achievement. And certainly was not giving actors on a regular basis a difficult challenge to work with. Maybe I'm wrong, maybe.
And I mean,
yeah.
But. Well, the way that we've talked about scenes, like, even just, he shows how loaded a single gesture can be in this film. And, like, most of the sequences that involve actual, like, emotive acting belong to Paul Winfield. And I will say that even though we're not given a whole lot of insight into his character, like, he expresses himself so well. Like, this is a difficult film. And I mean, not only in how to read it, but like, you can tell when Paramount was making it, like, they were terrified of the film that this could have turned into. And I think a large part of why it works is the performance of Paul Winfield. And again, it's like, he's this laconic but determined figure, and in some ways he's the perfect counterbalance against the dog, who's just this creature of pure anger and pure physicality. Whereas he's like stoic and calm in opposition to it, and he refuses to break in front of it. And like, you buy that conflict, and you buy, you know, that the despair in his voice when he thinks about the alternative. And in that final scene, when he has to pull the trigger, it is like, it feels very real. And it could very easily have turned into like just a schlocky, you know, Cujo retread, and it's not. And a large part of why it's not goes squarely to Paul Winfield.
Absolutely. But what about you, Andrew? Any other things you would like to highlight before we turn our attention to maybe some not-so-great aspects of this film?
I mean, I think we've identified a lot of it. Because, again, like, this is a film that's fairly superficial in some respects. Shout out to Paul Bartel, though, because in, like, two lines of dialogue as a camera operator, you know, and maybe this is also recency bias, but, like, you know, he gives a certain sense of character to his bit part.
Yeah.
And it's like, it almost, you know, it's like William Fichtner in The Dark Knight, where it's like, you do so little, but everything you do makes me wonder, like, who is this guy and what's his life like? So, yeah, I did like him, and it's always nice to see him. Yeah. But what about for the pits?
A pits in this one, and I'm going to qualify by pits by saying these are aspects that they're not terrible in the same way where, like, this is an outright problem, but there are things where I kind of raise an eyebrow at. And the first one I'm going to target is the first attack of the street sweeper scene. Because the actual attack by the dog is brutal and ugly and violent and vicious, and it is outright horrifying. And then, we then see what happens to the street sweeper he is driving, which is that it plows.
I love how we have the same hits and the same pits this week.
Yeah, in this case, it just plows into a storefront, smashing through the glass, and you're, like, I'm almost shocked that it didn't all of a sudden burst through the other side and run into a tanker truck with the way it's being staged, and you just have, like, this fireball explosion, because that's really all it's missing in terms of how far it goes. And that's
how pared down the rest of the film is, this scene stands out like a sore thumb. But it's also like, if you cut this scene, you probably could have made this film for $6 million instead.
Perhaps. I mean, yeah, it's very, I would love to know if anybody took a look at Fuller's light. It's like, you know, you could stage this in a much simpler manner than this, and it would cost us less, and again, does this really seem fitting when given that you're not making an action movie? Because, it's just so out of place for the rest of this movie. And is the one moment where you get the sense that, maybe this is the pulpier side. You know, the Sam Fuller who wrote the pulp novel Brainquake when he was in France during the late part of his life.
Brainquake? That's amazing.
Oh, it's available. It's worth reading because, oh boy, is it a doozy. That's certainly a pit. What about you, Andrew? Any other things you might have some issues with here?
I mean, the fact that the film is grim and doesn't leave you with any sense of closure or even a clear direction of where to go after that, that's not necessarily a pit, because that's intentional, I think. I would like to say, though, in lieu of a pit, because I was going to name the street sweeper collision, I would say that there is a hit that I forgot to mention, and that's the specific tracking shot that follows Julie out of her house right before she meets the dog's original owner. How the camera follows and gets closer and closer until she goes beyond the gate, and it's a tall gate that obscures vision. So when she swings it open, all of a sudden, like, the man's face just looms into the frame. And, like,
yeah,
just visually, it before we even know who this guy is, we are given the visual indication that something is decidedly not okay with this. And I think that's an interesting counterpoint to, like, especially the first half of the film, and all the scenes of the dog, like, in domestic space. And I think, in some ways, like, the cinematography is very clever in that the way that it takes stock shots and stock, like, tropes from any kind of animal story. And because of the film's overall message, like, all of a sudden we view that with suspicion and, like, a new perspective on it. And in doing so, it sort of indicates to us, like, the ways in which, you know, hatred and racism and prejudice not only are omnipresent in society, but the ways that we tolerate it. And even with Julie, like, I think something that we also forgot to mention, like, it's also, I think, unsatisfying and deeply problematic as well that she wants to save this dog because it's hers. It's the one that she knows, right? And so there's that belief that, well, maybe hatred is bad, but my dog has got to be different because it's mine and I love him. And, like, the discourse that plays into is the way that we are willing to overlook things. As we said before, with the Thanksgiving dinner example, it's like, well, you tolerate it because he's your grandpa, you know? And again, like, that's something that the film is not doing at sort of a an overt level. I think that happens purely at the level of mise-en-scène. But, I mean, even if that's unintended, it echoes beautifully with the messages that we are receiving from the film. So, kudos. Whether or not the, you know, 400 people that saw this for a week in 1982 picked up on that, probably not. But, I mean, that's Samuel Fuller in a nutshell. He was too controversial for the studios, but way too artistic for exploitation.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, are there any other pits from you, Dave?
Not really. I think that really the street sweeper scene is, like, it is just that one element that really sticks out like a sore thumb in an otherwise great movie. And, yeah, I mean, I would highly recommend getting your hands on this. I don't know whether the Criterion DVD release is still in print. I would hope it's one of the ones that eventually they'll get around to re-releasing on Blu and upgrading it, because it deserves a wider audience than it's had. And certainly, I would imagine it's probably easier now to track it down than it was any time before the late 2000s. So, that's certainly the case. And any final thoughts, Andrew?
Well, I mean, it's not an easy watch, and it's not a fun one, but I think it is an important one, and this definitely is a very bold filmmaking statement, and one that, you know, its relevance has only become more concentrated over time. And, yeah, I mean, it's a very different approach to how Hollywood deals with stories about race and how America grapples with its own history. And it took somebody like Samuel Fuller to convince Paramount to let him do it. So, I would say there's a lot of reasons to go see this movie. And if you can get a copy of it, I mean, do so. Not a lot of films will leave that lasting impression and leave that ongoing debate to be had for more than 20 minutes following the film. This is one of those ones that you'll keep considering and remains fluid every time you watch it. And, you know, I can't, off the top of my head, name a whole lot of other films I can say that about. So, that being said, I think it's about time to pull our street sweeper out of the ruined department store and blow some of the smoke off of it and hit the road once more. So, David, I'm probably going to have a little cat nap, or should I say dog nap. So why don't you take the wheel and tell us where we're going next?
Well, one person we didn't mention, I guess I could have mentioned as another hit in our previous segment, was this is a film that happens to have the one, the only Dick Miller in it. He's in it for about 30 seconds, but he's there. So Dick Miller, being the guy who appears in everything, is going to take us back to something I would say significantly lighter comparatively.
Wait, so this movie is a three-pointer then, because we have Paul Bartel for meeting Raoul, Dick Miller for meeting Raoul, and Ennio Morricone who did the score for Machine Gun McCain.
Was Dick Miller in Eating Raoul?
Wasn't he? I thought we talked about him last week. No, okay, never mind. Yeah. We're just still at two. I'm just exhausted. Carry on.
Yeah, anyways, we're going to travel back 20 years to 1962 to finally take a look at a film by a filmmaker we've sort of danced around last week, certainly, if not prior before, Roger Corman's The Premature Burial, starring Ray Milland, Hazel Court, Dick Miller, and Alan Napier, a.k.a. TV's Alfred. Yeah, that's going to be what we're looking at. It's based on an Edgar Allan Poe short story. So tune in and join us there. I mean, is it Roger Corman more than what people may think of him? We'll see. So until then, Andrew.
Yeah, it's our third week in a row of exploitation adjacent filmmaking.
Yeah. So in this case, Andrew, let's just say, I mean, as we've sort of acknowledged, we want to hear from people about this film. So where could they find you if they want to talk to you specifically?
You can reach me best at Filmstripper. I'm generally currently getting yelled at by as many as a dozen people at a time anyway, so what's a few more? You can usually find me on Twitter there, and yourself, Dave.
You can find me at 24Panels. I will certainly am always open to a nice conversation, and you know, hopefully we'll hear some very thoughtful responses towards this film and this episode in particular. If not, we won't take it personally.
We try to be civil and we don't block, so yeah, exactly.
Oh,
and,
I'll block!
As far as... Okay, well, yes. Send all your postcards to him. As far as the show itself, though, if you want to learn more about us, or if you like or dislike what you're hearing, head on over to iTunes or wherever you get this fantastic podcast, and feel free to rate and review. 5-star reviews are the best way to get new eyes and ears onto our show, but at the same time, honesty is important, and if you don't tell us what we're doing wrong, we can't do anything about it. Also proud to announce that apparently my dad now listens to our podcast, so if he can find a way to download it every week, I'm sure you can too.
That's a ringing endorsement. So, until then, Andrew, are there any parting words you'd like to leave us with?
Why, yes, there is, David. I actually prepared them this week. It's remember, everybody, adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you.
If Paramount doesn't block that from happening first.